to the Cup and Saucy Book Club. I'm Jen.
And I'm Zanna.
What's in your cup today, Zanna?
I'm drinking black chocolate tea from the Spice and Tea Exchange. How about you? What's in your cup this morning?
In honor of our guest today, I am drinking the same thing that I had the last time she was on the show, which is a homemade Mexican hot chocolate. And I wanted to look back at the episode to see what it was that I had made for that one. And I had guessed a particular tea and I was wrong, but that's okay. Because we love that we are welcoming back Adele Buck to the show. She was the very first guest that we had on the Cup and Saucy Book Club. And since she was last on the show, she has released her Center Stage series, and that's now out on audio, all four books. And Fake Flame was just released April 23rd by Harlequin Afterglow. So, Adele, welcome back to the show.
Hey. Thank you so much.
And so what have you been up to since the last time we talked?
A lot of writing and a lot of editing. So I think when I talked to you last, I was just about to submit the book that is now called Fake Flame.
Yeah. We talked about a lot of alternative titles for that.
Romance.
Yeah.
Yes, we did. We did. And here, and one of the things I remember I talked about was how a lot of this stuff that when you're an independent author, you have creative control over everything. And I mentioned how I knew I was not going to have as much control over things like titles. And little did I know, I have no control over titles because I actually literally found it's fine. I mean, the titles that they've come up with have been way better than any of my working titles. But I literally found out Fake Flame was called Fake Flame when I happened to zoom past Amazon. It's like it was already up there. Okay. Yeah. So, and it's funny because if my editor's listening to this, they're probably going, oh no. It's fine. It's absolutely fine. I care really what's inside the book most of all. I mean, these things matter because they're marketing, but at the end of the day, the stuff I have the most control over is also the stuff I care the most about.
Which is the story.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So Fake Flame went through developmental edits, then copy edits, and then it actually came back to me for yet another tweak that was a little bit more developmental because the senior editor had taken her final pass at it and she kind of identified something that just needed a little zhuzhing up, which was fine. One of the things I have learned is to just really not be precious about most of this.
Yep.
Care.
Kill your darlings, right?
you obviously have to care, you also have to recognize that you're not a perfect being.
Right.
Yeah, oddly enough.
Right.
Excuse me. So, people have been saying some lovely things about the book. Publishers Weekly gave it a rave. My husband is a great cook, and he was in the kitchen when my editor emailed me the link to the review, and he always wears earbuds in the kitchen, and usually I'm like, hey, he cannot hear me at all, right? And I shrieked so loudly, he actually came out of the kitchen and was like, is something wrong? I'm like, no!
What happened?
Publishers Weekly said wonderful things about my book. So that's been really exciting and thrilling. And so the other thing that is also coming out this year is my first holiday romance.
Ooh.
Mostly Christmas, but there is at least acknowledgement that is not the only thing that happens in December. It's about two social media managers, and it's called The Antisocial Season. And I was calling it The Social Season when I was writing it, which is a rubbish title. But I always have to have a title even if it's rubbish. I don't know why.
Well, yeah, because you have to have something to work with.
Yeah. I mean, some people can write, spec book number one, and I for some reason, I can't do that. So I am deep in the developmental edit phase of that right now. It's due back in a couple of weeks. And it was a for some reason, it was a really difficult book to write. And I was worried that it was garbage. And it came back from John, my editor, and they were like, it's not garbage. There's work to be done, but I really love it. And, you know, so that's been good.
It's nice to have that outside perspective, though, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, and I've always hired editors when I've been on my own. But it's one of those things where, you know, when you hire an editor, sometimes you worry a little bit that, like, are you getting their most objective?
Right. Are you giving me this review because I'm paying you?
Right.
Yeah. I shouldn't even think that because I, you know, the editors that I've had have all been
professionals,
including
yeah.
John. Yeah, exactly. But there's still that little edge of like, be harder on this.
It's like asking your therapist, would we still be friends if I weren't paying you?
Yeah, kind of, yeah. Yeah.
Like, no,
little like teeth gritty. Yeah, no.
They're professionals. Yeah.
And right. So that's been really good to go through that book and realize it's not rubbish and that there's parts of it that are funny, which is intentional, and there's a truly terrible family member in it. And I was given license to make her even worse.
Oh, fine.
That's nice.
Which when you're dealing with a raving narcissist, if you've ever had one in your life, there's no bottom. And so it's sort of like you worry a little that is this too much? Is this too much? Is this too much? No, you can actually go further.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Yeah. And it's still true.
There is
to
no
that,
lower
to
you
that
can
personality
go.
Style. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You'll never
yeah.
get rock bottom.
Sadly, no. But yeah. So it's and you know when you've dealt with someone like that, there's sort of no lack of ideas too,
right?
Because you've lived through it.
Right. Sadly, that's true.
Adele, the last time that we talked, you had just signed with Harlequin. And you were making the transition from independent author to traditional publishing. And you had some thoughts about that at the time, but it wasn't like you weren't fully integrated into the traditional publishing world. So how has that transition been for you now that we're much more into this? And what do you see as, what surprised you about that?
Well, the title thing surprised me. You mm-hmm. know, just to not have any input on it. It was almost a pleasant surprise because titling is second only to writing back cover copy in my list of things I really don't like about publishing independently.
Right.
And also, I mean, the back cover copy that I've gotten has just been, I mean, I've heard horror stories, but oh my God, I've loved both back cover copy blurbs that I've gotten for both books that are currently, you know, available for pre-order.
Those
or,
are different skills from writing
and,
a book.
Yeah,
the blurb and
they really are. They really are.
So it's nice that you can outsource that.
Yeah, I had another friend who is an author. She told me once that it's writing a book is like having a long conversation with someone. Writing the blurb is like saying hi in the elevator. So, you know, you say as much as you can say in that elevator conversation while you're going down five floors, but, you know, you're not really saying a whole lot.
Yeah. And it's also, it's just such a different, it's a different voice entirely.
Yeah.
A marketing mm-hmm. voice, a sales voice
is
very, very different from
a
storytelling voice. And at least for my own books, I have a couple of friends who have helped me. Ainsley Payton has helped me tremendously. She's an independent mm-hmm. author in Australia, and she's also her day job. She is a marketing copywriter, and she's really good at it. So she's helped me a tremendous amount, and so has Brenda St. John, mm-hmm. who's in England. She's an American, but she lives in England, and she's another independent author, and she's really good at it too. So these two ladies have mm-hmm. really saved my bacon in terms of my independent books, because otherwise it would be like, this is a book, stuff happened,
right.
please buy it.
Right.
Yeah. Well, and now and now you have the expertise in the traditional publisher, and Harlequin, I mean, is nobody does the longevity and just the mass of books that they have. So, because they've been doing it for years, so that must have
75. In fact,
75.
This
yeah,
year
that's
is
right.
their 75th anniversary.
That's right.
Which is exciting to have two books coming out in the 75th anniversary year too. So that's
yeah. So it's even more to celebrate.
I sort of think of Harlequin as being like the Xerox or the Kleenex of the romance world. So. Yeah, so it's like it's a Harlequin.
Yeah, the brand that you use
really
instead of the name.
Or, yeah, right. So yeah. You know if it's a Harlequin, it's a romance.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, although it's interesting because Harlequin has various imprints that do things like, you know, they do mystery.
Yeah. And they do nonfiction too, because I have a title published under a Harlequin nonfiction. So yeah.
Okay. So they're more versatile than people know, but they're very, very clever about segmenting and targeting various audiences and giving them exactly what they want.
Okay.
And Afterglow in some ways was a response to a lack, because one of the things that had happened was that, of course, the wonderful Blaze line went away several years ago. Gosh, maybe 10, 15 years ago. I don't know how long ago it went away. But and that was explicitly a high heat line. And so that went away, and Dare had been around for a long time, but Dare didn't actually really have a mandate for heat level and explicitness. And so you kind of didn't, and that's one of the reasons why it went away. And it was replaced by Afterglow. And Afterglow is explicitly a high heat line, because there's plenty of closed door, you know, no explicit lines to choose from Harlequin. But they realized that they were kind of getting their, I think, not to tell tales out of school, but this is really only my opinion, they were probably looking around the marketplace and going, we're getting our lunch eaten by, you know, lines like, you know, Forever and Berkeley and things like that, who were publishing more high heat stuff. And as someone who, you know, really likes writing that, because it's funny that one of John's recent observations was they are very, very good at getting this Scandinavian to dig for emotion. Because when I say Scandinavian, you know, I don't
as
know.
As a Scandinavian myself,
saw,
I understand.
There's yeah. Well, if you haven't seen it, there's a really wonderful Hallmark movie that came out this past year called My Norwegian Holiday. And it is an absolute delight. And it was filmed principally in Bergen. And there's this wonderful conversation that this American has with this Norwegian family around the dinner table. And she says something about how she loves something. And they all kind of laugh. And she's like, what's funny? And they say, well, you know, you Americans, you love everything. You love, you know, you love your grandfather. You love the dinner. You love, you know, whatever. And they go through and she's like, well, what do you say?
Right,
and they have different words for, like, you know, I can't remember the exact words.
Yes,
and
but
I know
for
the
level
I know the words
of interest.
For, I love you. Yeah. For, well, you know, that one, there's a, you know, a little joke about this, you know, the father says, you know, if I, you know, I, you know, I love Taylor Swift, and everybody laughs. He goes, what? I'm a Swiftie. and then they go through various levels of it. And then finally they, you know, they get to Yiskade, which is, I love you in a deep, emotionally committed way. And there's an engaged couple at the table, and the woman looks at her fiance and sort of like, you know, he's not that you ever say it. And he said, I said it once. And she kind of grins at him, and he says, I'll let you know if things change.
That might be the most Norwegian thing I've ever heard.
I mean, I cannot think of anything more Scandinavian, frankly. We aren't effusive people. And so John really gets me to dig deeper, and to the point of writing sex scenes. They noted that this is actually where I am fine with getting very deeply emotional. Right. That kind of, you know, I get almost zero notes on my sex scenes, like maybe zero. And everywhere else in these more mundane conversations, can you dig here? Can we get a little here? How do they feel about it? What's going on? And I get a ton of that everywhere else.
Right.
But in the sex scenes, it's crickets, except for at the end, I might get an, oh my God. Right. Which you love to see from your editor. You just really love to see it.
Yeah. Well, and yeah, because the less they're using that red pen, the better.
Yes and no. Like I said, I like getting the feedback because I often know something is wrong with a specific thing. And when I'm deep in the weeds of it, I don't know what it is.
Right.
And Neil Gaiman said something about this, and he said something to the effect of the comment that something is wrong is always correct. The suggestion to fix it is almost always wrong.
Huh.
And I agree with that, but I love the suggestion to fix it because my immediate, no, that doesn't work, and why, and the way my brain kicks into gear with disagreeing with the specific fix points me to the actual
Give
fix.
Me something to work off of.
Right. It gives you a direction.
Yeah, give me something to bounce back.
Yeah. Yeah. It gives me something to push against.
No,
yeah.
I like that.
Yeah.
That's wrong, but I think I know what the way to fix it.
So yeah, it's exactly. No, they would never say that because X, Y, and Z. Oh, but they would say A.
Yeah. Well, and it gives you a place to jump off from, particularly if you're stuck, knowing that this isn't working, but I'm not really sure how to dig myself out of the hole, you know?
Exactly.
And that expression always cracks me up because it's like, okay, all you do is end up digging deeper sometimes if it's just you to yourself. But so to have that support as a now traditional author must be wonderfully refreshing after all of that time as an independent author and going, okay, so I'm doing this myself. I'm doing this myself and so on. But I know that So we have spoken to a lot of independent authors in the years since we've talked to you, and so that it's nice to come back to a traditional publishing perspective because it's not something that we often talk about, and there are pluses and minuses to both. So you know we're not going to state, okay, well this way is the better way, end of story. You know, it's finding what works best for you as the author. And it sounds like, it sounds like you're doing, you're in a happier space because there is that support for you. Is that an accurate statement?
It is accurate. I mean, their publishing has tons and tons and tons of issues. I mean, I will never say, oh, this is just the most wonderful industry ever and it's all sunshine and roses and, you know, it's not, it's absolutely not. But one of the things that is great about being traditionally published is that it takes so many things off of my plate that I don't like to do and am frankly not good at.
Right.
You know, I am okay. I'm good at admin. That's fine. But you know what? I have a day job, and so I have a limited amount of time to devote to this side hustle of writing, and I'd prefer to do it mostly on the creative end. And, you know, it's not uncommon. And, you know, just the fact that I now have this enormous marketing machine out there getting interest, you know, they put out a, you know, as we're recording this, Fake Flame has not released yet, and they put 20 copies on Goodreads as for a giveaway. And as of yesterday, I think it was over 4,000 people had requested.
Oh, wow. That's wonderful.
Yeah. And I had done it. I had done a Goodreads giveaway once when they did Goodreads did a sale. And so I gave away 100 copies of Method Acting just to see kind of like, let's see what happens with this. And I think I got like, you know, I did not get 1,000.
Yeah.
Let's put it that way. So just seeing that level of exposure is gratifying because there's so much of being an independent author that feels like you're sort of wailing into the void.
Yeah.
And that's very demoralizing, honestly, because, you know, you've got people who tell you, you know, you've got, you know, your friends who tell you wonderful things about your books, and that's fantastic. And, like, you know, I have some very good friends who are, you know, very honest with me. So I know that not everybody loves my books, or all of them. You know, like Suzanne Brockman, you know, has loved some of my books, and she has really disliked at least one of my books. And she did not scruple to tell me that. And I love her for that, because, and she was like, I'm sorry if I hurt your feelings. I'm like, they are fine.
Right.
My feelings are fine.
Yeah.
You know, which is really weird, because Suze went from being an absolute hero of mine mm-hmm. to being a friend. And, you know, that's
right.
Whiplash. but yeah, it's just it's a whole different mm-hmm. level of exposure.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're playing in a much bigger lake outside of, you know, an independent mm-hmm. pond. But at the same time, you are also supported by bigger fish. So, you know, it's not like you're just going to get swallowed up and forget it. But yeah, there are drawbacks to traditional publishing, and just like there are drawbacks to indie publishing too. So, you know, I think it's really what is best for the author. And it sounds like because you know your skill sets, and you know what you're good at and what you're not, and so having that support in the places where you don't feel as comfortable is wonderful to hear. And it really does sound like, since the last time we talked to you, that that you sound a lot more supported, and you're not just, I won't say you were flailing around last year, but it was definitely a little more. I'm trying.
Well, it's just, and also just, I mean, the learning curve, it hasn't been quite as steep as one might think, because I've been paying attention for a lot of years, and I've been, you know, I have been listening. I mean, you know, whenever you start with something like this, I mean, I think there's a tendency to kind of come in with rose-colored glasses. And, you know, when I first got my first agent, I was like, okay, this is all going to go from here. And then, you know, 4 years later, we part ways, and I am at a completely low ebb. And and that was really honestly terrible, because one of the things that happened, so this was during the pandemic, one of the things that happened was my friend Eden Apiakubi, who I used to commute with. I used to be like her daughter's train auntie, because we would all ride the local rail into DC before her family moved to a different town. And we would talk publishing. We were both unpublished. We were starting out. We were sort of kind of, we're coming up together. And then she got her deal to publish The Bennett Women. And, you know, I could not open anything without seeing ads everywhere for this book. And she was clearly so supported. And I was, on one level, I was so happy for her, but I was also so deeply depressed about my own position in, or lack thereof. And that's a terrible way to feel, because you just want to have unalloyed happiness for your friend, because she is a wonderful person and a fabulous writer. And, you know, I am absolutely blessed to know her. So just like, darn it, squishy human parts, you know, just get in line and just
brains
be happy.
Don't always work
just forget
that
about
way.
Yourself.
No, brains
for a minute,
don't always do that. Yeah.
They don't. You don't darn these things.
Well, and but both things can be true.
Oh, so for sure.
You can both be happy for for your friend, and then be, you know, depressed about how you know, things are going in your own life or your own track.
Like, when is it my turn?
Yeah, exactly. It's absolutely, I was having those horrible, you know, sort of feeling sorry for myself feelings, and I hate
those are the worst. Those are very much the worst.
Yeah,
they are. You know, just to be perfectly honest about, like, you know, how this entire thing has played out over the years. You know, and the last year or so has been an absolute high, almost nonstop. But boy, howdy, it took me a while and a lot of other stuff to get to this point.
Well, and then that, I think that that makes the place that you're at now all the sweeter, because you know what you had to do to get there and how yeah. hard you had to work and, you know, the disappointments that you had to face. So,
yeah.
I think it's a success well earned then.
Well, thank you. It's interesting that you say that, because I have right here, I have a framed tweet from Beverly Jenkins after I announced my book deal, she wrote, "You earned this with your hard work and staying focused. Much success going forward. Proud of you."
Oh,
and
wow.
And I was like, I am printing that out and framing it.
Yeah.
And I literally did, because like, oh my God, Ms. Bev herself.
Excellent. Yeah.
Just legend. Okay. Just full stop. So yeah. So I have really tried hard to, and I actually I don't even have to try hard to remember that I am very, very fortunate.
Yeah. But it's also, it's luck and hard work, mm-hmm. together. So what are we looking at for the next year? If we,
so the next year, sometime, yeah, right. So sometime, next year, probably in the spring at some point, book three will come out.
Mm-hmm.
And it is tentatively titled Stunner.
Okay.
And also all of these books are part of what we've dubbed the First Responder series, because book two, even though it's about social media managers, the heroine of that book is a secondary character in book one. And she was one of the hero's colleagues on the fire squad. And there's a traumatic event. I gave the heroine a rather unusual living situation. In that she lives in an accessory building on a wealthy woman's, an elderly wealthy widow's estate, essentially.
Okay.
She's gone through this traumatic event that causes her to want to leave the fire department. And that's how she becomes the social media manager for the emergency services department. And she is taught how to, you know, she's coached in how to do this by somebody who does it for the county library system, who is... someone who she forgot that she knew in high school, and he had a crush on her and she never knew.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So that's our second first responder. So our third first responder, the heroine is yet again a tertiary character one of the daughters of the wealthy widow. And she is a mechanical engineer, and she is on her way to a job site where, you know, she slips and falls and cracks her head on the sidewalk, and Stunner gets a concussion. And one of the paramedics who comes and scoops her off the pavement is her brother's former best friend. So he is the third first responder.
Okay.
As an EMT paramedic nurse. He's a nurse who wants to get out of bedside patient care entirely. And had, during the COVID pandemic, had been a travel nurse, because travel nurses could really make just a ton of money. And because he wants to get a master's in public health and go into mm-hmm. the sort of administration side of things. And he was almost to his goal line with savings, and he got COVID himself. And just,
oh, no. Yeah.
Yeah. So he's better now, but he just doesn't have it in him to continue to do that. So he's kind of piecing together this mm-hmm. this livelihood. And so what ends up happening is that he picks Katrina up off the sidewalk, and, you know, and so because he knows her family, you know, he calls the mother, and the mother comes and gets her, and Katrina's like, "I don't have time to have a concussion. I have a business to run. I have to go to a wedding in a week." And her mother is like, "There is no way you're mm-hmm. driving to North Carolina at all." And so she, being the wealthy widow, hires our hero to be both her driver and her on-call nurse.
Right. Brother's best friend. You've got
only one bed.
Road trip.
We got wedding. We got brother's best friend. We've got only one bed. I basically threw every trope I could think of at this. The only trope that there's no amnesia, because some people are like, oh, a concussion, does she have amnesia? I'm like, no, you will absolutely never get an amnesia book from me because I hate those things.
Yep, we don't like amnesia, and we wake up and it's all a dream.
Probably will never get a secret baby book from me either, because there's, as far as I'm concerned, in contemporary, there's only one good one that I know of, and that's Serena Bowen's Bountiful.
Because that
one makes actual perfect sense.
Right.
But usually it's so contrived and makes zero sense and whatever. And speaking of Serena Bowen, so I know we talked about her last time.
Yes.
Lovely woman that she is. I will have you know that in about a month I am going to my first hockey game.
Oh.
Okay. So let's see. We set the clock right now, Zanna, on when Adele's first hockey romance is.
Never. But it's funny because I went to a private prep school for high school, and they come to town occasionally, and usually they have cocktails or something like that, and say, please give us money. But this time they actually got a block of tickets at the Capitals, Washington Capitals. Mm-hmm. And so, I said to the husband, I said, hey, want to go to a hockey game? And he's like, I guess. So we're gonna go.
we'll check back after the game to see if that's still a no on the hockey romance.
I love to read them, but I just, the level of knowledge about the sport is something I will just never have, I don't think, because it's, as far as I'm concerned, if you're going to write a sports romance, you have to know a lot about the sport.
We've been talking about this somewhat, and I think part of the appeal of hockey romance is that it's sort of a sport that people know about, but it's not a sport that many people have lost spouses to. Like, you can lose your spouse to football or baseball or, depending internationally, definitely to
Premier League soccer here.
And whereas hockey, while it does have an audience, doesn't have as big of an audience as some of those other sports where people are going to just become sports widows. And the other thing is the suits, because they dress up in suits after.
The suits are there, but let's not ignore the elephant in the room. It's also an exceedingly white sport.
It is sadly
for some people part of the appeal. And then,
we've discussed what other romances could make it. Zanna seems to think that curling needs, that a curling romance needs to happen.
I love curling.
I have yet to be convinced.
Fun fact, Steve Amidon, who is an archivist who works in pop culture and principally romance, used to be the archivist at Bowling Green State University's Pop Culture Library and just knows a boatload about the history of romance and things like that. He is a curler, and some of us have said, Steve, you just need to write a curling romance once and for all. And he so far has resisted, but I think it would be a goddamn delight.
If he ever caves, please make sure that Zanna gets a copy.
There's also professional cornhole, which is something that Jen and I ended up watching the finals of when we were stuck in.
No.
I know,
the
right?
Jokes.
The
jokes. Tell themselves.
Jen and I ended up watching the cornhole national championship when we were stuck in California during the Cova hurricane of 23. Yep.
We were at a book event during the book event everything was great. Yep. Immediately following it though, several of the authors had to drop out because they got COVID. Then there was a hurricane coming
for
the California coast.
Never happens.
Southern California coast.
During the tropical storm.
During the middle of it.
Yeah, there was an earthquake.
Yeah, it turned out to be a tropical storm, but, LA and rain don't mix, so.
Don't mix, no.
And so, they were blowing up the whole thing. And then in the middle of it, there was an earthquake. So we just sort of wrote it out in the hotel room
looking for things to do, and what, you know, kept looking around on the TV, and we just kept coming back to the Cornhole Championship.
It was oddly compelling.
I mean, I'm sorry. After the potato shifter.
Right. Yeah, we also were reading.
From potato shifter to cornhole championship it was a little too much farm country for me. Okay.
Oh, dear.
I am an urban, a suburban and urban kid.
You know, I grew up in a flyover state. So
a little too much farming for me. So, yeah.
I grew up in New Hampshire. Yeah. I grew up in farm country, man.
Yeah.
You know, it's now basically a bedroom community for Boston, but in my little hometown. But when I grew up, it was like half the land was taken up with either dairy farming or orchards or like strawberries and, you know, other produce.
Yeah.
So
so we were there for a book event, Steamy Lit Con. Do you have any book events or publisher get-togethers on your schedule? Not yet.
I was a little behind in trying to get like my act together to like put myself forward for these things, and so I missed out on Steamy. I missed out on a Polycon. I missed out on. Hopefully next year I will. I believe be doing a signing at the Ripped Bodice in Brooklyn sometime this summer with MC Vaughn, who is one of my fellow Afterglowians. And she and I both live north of D.C., so we're like, yeah, we can even take the train together. Why not?
Wonderful.
So I have that to look forward to, and you know, I'm on waiting lists for various things, so I might pop up at something. I'm not holding my breath at this point, which is kind of fine, ish. I want to do various things. There's a smaller conference. It's newer, called the Write Women. Write, W-R-I-T-E, Women Book Fest, which is very local to me, that I could have done this year, but I didn't want to buy all of my own books because I was going to have to do that because at that point I didn't have anything traditionally published. But my dear friend Maria Vale came down for that, and I had dinner with her, so that was fun.
So it ended up being a good dinner anyway.
Yeah, anytime I can hang with Maria Vale is a good time, because she is just a wonderful human being and writes some of the best paranormal out there, as far as for my money. Because the thing I always say about Maria is that other people might sort of have otherworldly characters. Maria's characters, there is zero question that these are not human beings.
Okay.
Her wolf shifters, they are absolutely wolves first. All of her societal world building is built around wolf pack behavior. So even if they are, as they would put it, in skin, they never call themselves human, ever. They, first of all, they will always behave still like wolves. So like if one of their pups runs up to them while they're in human-looking form, they will pick the pup up and they will rub it against their jawline to mark it the same way they would if they were shaggy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so like all of the societal stuff is wonderful. And we had a, I'm actually currently wearing part of the result of this. So when we had the Romance for Maui auction, raised quite a bit of money for the wildfires. She had a lot of her books, her Legend of All Wolves series, up for auction, together with a sweatshirt from the New York Wolf Conservation Center.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wearing the sweatshirt. I wear the sweatshirt practically every day. It's like, unless it's in the wash, it's on my body, it feels like. So I was like, I've read all of these books. Of course I've read all of these books, but I don't have any of them in paperback, and the covers are beautiful. So when I won that lot, because I actually set a timer for like 4 minutes before the auction was going to end, because if you do it within 3 minutes of the end of the auction, they extend the time so that somebody else has a chance to outbid you. So I literally like 4 minutes.
Wow, you
before
really
the
studied
end
that.
Of, yeah. I did. I was gonna get that lot, and I outbid the other person by like 50 cents, and I got it. And so she gave me the opportunity to actually wait to get my copies, because she was kind of caught up in that. Her first couple books were in mass market, and then like the middle book was in mass market max, and then the last two books were in trade. And so she's like, they're reissuing all of them in trade, and if you wait, I can send you the
all
set
of them together.
All,
yeah,
they all right. look like a set.
Yeah,
and I was like, I can wait. I've already read these. It's fine. And so literally, I had not gotten COVID for 4 years. I had not gotten it. Right. Of course, the day it arrives, I test positive for COVID, and I'm like, okay, well, Paxlovid and hanging out with Maria.
Yeah,
let's bring it. That's what I did. Oh, by the way, I'm cursing you both because you recently had the lovely Julia Whalen on and talking about Casanova LLC, which I was already on my radar. And so I ordered the serial version of it.
Right.
Uh-huh. And I listened to the first two episodes and I was like, well, the hell with that. I've got to get the rest of it now.
Yeah.
And then I bought the Rabbit Hole edition. And I'm like, Julia, just take all my money. Okay, just take it.
Right?
Take it. I have listened to that damn thing twice. I love it. I love it beyond reason. It is so good. And it's interesting because I don't usually love full cast recordings. In fact, I usually can't even listen to them.
Right.
Because usually they're done by actors who are not great narrators, and oftentimes they are like have a lot of extraneous, like they sound like a radio play with all of the, like the and the ding dong and you know like fight noises and you know whatever, and I can't and if the voices are not differentiated enough, I can't tell who's talking, and I can't listen to them usually. And so I was a little leery, but because it was Julia and because it was Sebastian York, I was like, okay, well, I'll give this a try. And oh my dear Lord, it is so good.
Oh, yeah.
Because I had also just recently listened to Jenny Holliday's Canadian Boyfriend.
Yeah.
Which is done in duet as well. And I was a little leery. I was like, I don't know how I'm going to feel about this. And that was also very well done. And I liked that a lot too. So I had just come off of that experience and into this experience, and I was like, okay, well, I'm okay. All right. So I don't hate all of these. This is good.
Right.
Well, and Eduardo Ballerini we love him so much.
Oh my God. What a wonderful, I mean, I could see this old Italian.
Yeah.
You know, just. Yeah. Just textbook old Italian guy, and you know I loved it when she talked about how do you say mi sposi or whatever, and how he like she forgot she asked him how to pronounce it, and she gets this voice message from him to and he says it, and she's like, ooh. Yeah, there's something about Italian.
Yeah.
And
I don't know what it is.
We got advanced copies to
I know.
Listen to that. And but I will still end up buying the Rabbit Hole, because we didn't get copies of the whole thing, but we didn't get bloopers and all of the other little extras you have to have the complete total package. We are sorry, not sorry about that one.
Yeah, that's right.
Me too. Honestly, it's just fine. It's fine. My bank account can take it. But it's just such a delight. And those four actors just wow.
Yeah.
Absolutely wow.
It's wonderful. So I'm glad that we influenced you in the best way. And we do want to say thank you so much, Adele, for being on the show, and it's good to see you. And we'll be having everything that we talked about on today's show will be available on our show notes page on our website, cupandsaucybooks.com.
Thank you.
You can also follow us on social media at Cup and Saucy Books. We're on Instagram, TikTok, and Threads. If you like what you hear, review and subscribe to the show on your favorite pod platform.
Thank you for joining us for the Cup and Saucy Book Club. Join us next time for more great conversations about the world of books.
And likely tangents.
Happy reading.
Cheers.